From NPR News and Notes, this is Farai Chidea. Is Hillary Clinton playing the race card as we wind down the final Democratic primaries? And the United Nations World Food Program nearly stops all aid into Myanmar. Plus, 13 Philadelphia police officers are reassigned to desk duty after they were caught on tape beating and kicking three shooting suspects. Here on our reporters' roundtable, we've got John Yearwood, world editor at the Miami Herald, Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley, and Chandra Thomas, assistant editor and writer for Atlanta Magazine. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hello, Farai.
Hello.
Happy Friday. Well, let's talk politics first. Today, Barack Obama picked up three more superdelegate endorsements, one from a union president and two from congressmen. One of those congressmen is New Jersey Representative Donald Payne, who was an avid Clinton supporter. Now, there have been other Clinton supporters who've essentially defected. Rochelle, do you see the writing on the wall for Senator Clinton, despite the fact that she continues to fight on and on and on?
The writing has been on the wall like a child who's been made to write over and over on the blackboard, "I need to quit, I need to quit," and is ignoring it. I think that some of the tactics that she's using now are laced with desperation and really may hurt her chances at doing anything past this election.
What do you think the exit strategy is, Chandra? A lot of people have said, okay, one thing on the table is that Barack Obama should offer to pay her campaign debts since she's put $11.4 million of her own into the campaign. Other people have said, just make her the vice presidential candidate. What's the exit strategy?
Well, I think it's very interesting that Senator Obama has kind of kept that door open, as you mentioned, for her to run for vice president. He's a smart guy. And he knows that he should definitely keep that door open. I really don't feel that he's indebted to Senator Clinton at all. And apparently that seems to be her thought process, is that Barack Obama does owe her, which I think is why it's been so difficult for her to accept that he is actually leading.
John, let's address the issue of race here. Yesterday, Senator Clinton found herself in a bit of hot water. She spoke to USA Today and claimed that she, not Obama, has appeal among, quote, hardworking white Americans. Exit polls do show that Senator Clinton scores better with blue-collar white voters than Senator Obama, but critics are accusing her of race baiting. Do you think that that charge is fair?
Well, a couple of things, Farai. First of all, though, let me say hello to a good-working African-American who is Rochelle Riley, who is a good friend of mine.
Thank you, John.
It's really clear, though, that I think Rochelle mentioned that the writing has been on the wall for some time. And I think one of the things that we run the risk of happening here is that Hillary Clinton runs the risk of ignoring something that she has said before, that it takes, in effect, a village to win the Democratic, not only the Democratic nomination, but ultimately for a Democrat to win the White House. And the more she carries on talking about this race issue, the more you see that village sort of sectioning off into bits and pieces. And I think at some point in the not-too-distant future, I think we'll get to the point where Mrs. Clinton is going to have to call it quits. Because if you look at the numbers just don't add up at this point. And I'm not quite sure exactly how she sees a path to the nomination remaining. From what I've seen and from what I've read, some people have given her a 5% chance if that much. So I think in fairly short order, maybe after the next primary in West Virginia, we'll probably see that tent folding. But I think one of the things that she really needs to be careful about going forward is whether or not she further splinters this Democratic coalition that's needed to win the White House in November.
Rochelle, you're in Michigan. John's in Florida. Senator Clinton doesn't want to give up the primary results from these states. Now, in Michigan, she was the only candidate among the two remaining on the ticket at all. So the DNC says these delegates will be seated somehow. But what do you think, first of all, how are people feeling in Michigan? And what do you think is going to happen on that score?
Well, there are some folks who are wondering why Hillary Clinton was not upset when the DNC first decided to disenfranchise voters back in December, when they said, if you hold this primary, we won't seat your delegates. So all of a sudden, this seemed to be a surprise when they actually did it. And of course, now they're not going to, and they've come up with the proposal that they think is fair. But the bigger issue is that she looks very hypocritical, in that this was all fine back in January, and as long as nobody was getting delegates, there was no big discussion about disenfranchised voters, but now that she needs them, all of a sudden they've become important. And there is something else. If she isn't careful, she's going to alienate, or she already has alienated, some of the people that she's been counting on, whether she's talking about hardworking Americans who shouldn't be disenfranchised, or hardworking white Americans who somehow she seems to feel are more important for a little bit than hardworking Americans who, quite frankly, have succeeded economically. And some of these folks she's talking about aspire to those same things. If you're going to appeal only to the poor and paint your candidate, your opponent, as elitist, then what are you doing with folks who have raised themselves up and tried to do better? I think that she's forgetting her woman base in focusing just on those blue-collar, hardworking folks, particularly the guys that she's chugging beers with in bars. One of the things that's clear is that she's got about 60% of white votes in some of these primaries, but that means that Barack Obama has gotten 40%, which is unprecedented historically. So she's making a lot of arguments that don't make sense, and the superdelegates now have to pay attention. But as for Michigan,
let me jump in. We just have, sorry to do that. We have a couple more topics we got to get to, and not too much time.
Okay.
I'm going to move on to Chandra, talk a little bit about the tragedy in Myanmar. The cyclone has killed as many as 100,000 people. The numbers keep going up and leaving a million residents displaced. The military government didn't accept aid into the country until yesterday. And even then, the government seized the food and medical supplies and didn't want to let relief workers into the country. What are you hearing? You know, there was a huge outpouring of support across race, across, you know, the country for the tsunami. Is this playing out in Atlanta? Are people paying attention? Do you think there's going to be some money that ends up going to this cause?
I definitely find this case interesting. This morning, the discussion on the government coming out basically saying that they want aid, but they do not want personnel. And I think that's sort of the case of the beggars can't be choosy. You're actually asking for aid, but then you're also specifying how it needs to be administered. And I know there's a lot of concern about whether the government would or the military would actually take these supplies and not administer it to the victims. But I think what was echoing here in Atlanta is this seems very eerily reminiscent of Hurricane Katrina, and there's a lot of Hurricane Katrina victims here, and I just found it interesting that the U.S. Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance was even at one point considering just dropping off supplies without permission, whereas here in America, when Americans were needing supplies, somehow we couldn't find them for several days. And I think that a lot of people are finding this aggressive approach very interesting, and I just wonder if maybe this director of the Foreign Disaster should be promoted to head of FEMA.
Well, John, you know, what about this? I mean, is the U.S. Rhetoric possibly undercutting this country's ability to dialogue with what is clearly a military junta?
Well, there are a few things at play here, and I know one of the things that we saw right after this happened, at least shortly after it happened, is that the First Lady came out in a really unusual move, in which she called the junta there to open up to international aid, particularly aid from the United States. But one of the problems that the junta has is the fact that the U.S. doesn't recognize it. In fact, when the U.S. talks about aid going to Myanmar, they're talking about aid going to Burma, a country that according to the junta, no longer exists. And it's like saying, Farai, that it's like me calling you Tavis every time I pay you a compliment on this show. The junta clearly is not going to like it. But I think one good move that we saw today, however, was that they acknowledged that this aid is badly needed, and they're going to open the door to American assistance, which I think is really significant. What we're seeing is a slight opening from this junta to the aid that's expected to pour in. The U.S. has several ships in the area where people are willing to give aid. The junta has acknowledged itself that some 60,000 people run the risk of dying or missing out there.
All right. John, Chandra, and Rochelle, this is a speed round. Very tight. There was a beating in Philadelphia. More than 15 officers, all of them white, were caught on tape, yanking three black suspects from a car, kicking and beating them. 13 have been reassigned. Reverend Al Sharpton says it's worse than Rodney King. Is this story going to grab headlines and mobilize people? John first.
I think it will, and not only in this country, but we're also seeing it mobilizing headlines around the world where people are looking at the U.S. as a country without laws.
Chandra?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how we're so quick to say this is not a racial issue. The commissioner, who is black, saying automatically this is not an issue. And I think this is going to boil down to what is proper police procedure. And clearly, 3-1 and pummeling restrained suspects is not proper police procedure.
Rochelle, do you think that this is going to actually mobilize people across the country and not just people locally?
No. I think in this case, we as Americans sometimes do not believe what we see. I think this will go the way of cases that have happened over and over, and until it happens to enough people or to the right person, we will continue to see these cases, and they will get worse and worse.
All right. I want to thank all three of you for your time.
Anytime,
Farai. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rochelle Riley is a columnist at the Detroit Free Press. She spoke with us from the studios at the University of Michigan. John Yearwood is world editor at the Miami Herald. He joined us from the studios at the Miami Herald. And we also spoke with Chandra Thomas, an assistant editor and writer for Atlanta Magazine. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On practically any night of the week, you can turn on the television and see some crime investigator pulling out a swab to grab evidence samples for the fictional cases on TV. But the basis for hit shows like CSI Crime Scene Investigation is very real. Just these days, forensic scientists play a key role in the criminal justice system. They collect and examine microscopic samples that could send someone to jail or to freedom. How has technology changed the way crimes are solved? To give us some insight, we've got Dwayne Mosey, a retired criminalist from the California Department of Justice. He's currently an instructor in criminalistics at National University in San Diego. Welcome, Dwayne.
Thank you.
So, first off, what is criminalistics?
Criminalistics is the application of the physical sciences to matters of law and science, the physical sciences being biology, chemistry, and physics, and any question that might become of interest to not only law enforcement, but the legal system in general, whether it's criminal law or civil law, questions of science can be answered and aid in the assignment of responsibility and guilt or innocence in
Dwayne,
many types of situations.
Why don't you describe to us some of the work that you did with actual cases when you were at the California Department of Justice? I mean, what was your job literally and physically?
Literally, I went to the scene of the crime. I was often the one who collected all the evidence. I also did photography of the crime scene. I did not do fingerprints. There was usually a technician who did that. Back at the laboratory, I would take all that evidence that I had collected and inventoried, and I would begin a systematic investigation of that. As an example, one case in the middle of my career was a triple homicide, and it was a great case from a physical evidence standpoint. There was bullets, there was blood, there was saliva on cigarette butts, there was hair, there was soil, and I got to basically do it all. And what was really interesting is I presented all this evidence to the jury, laid out a scenario for the crime, and during the time I was testifying, the defendant called his girlfriend and confessed the crime to her and then threatened her with death if she ever talked. Well, 5 minutes later, she called the DA and told the DA about the confession, and she came in to testify at that point, and what she testified to was basically what I had testified to from the physical evidence standpoint.
It sounds like in that case, the physical evidence and then witness testimony works together. But sometimes I'm sure that you have to use the physical evidence alone. And how is it presenting to a jury? Do you find that they are entranced by the evidence you give, suspicious? What kind of reactions do you get?
Usually the jury will judge the witness. And if the witness appears credible in the eyes of the jury, then the evidence is credible. And if the witness does not appear credible, then the jury will ignore the evidence.
Let me ask about fictional investigations. The CBS television show CSI Crime Scene Investigation started broadcasting almost 8 years ago, and it tells the story of forensic scientists solving crimes in a glitzy, fast-paced style. And some people say the drama has changed forensic science and even possibly changed criminal behavior. What do you think?
Well, two things. One, juries now demand to see more exhibits in trial that reflect the science behind what the criminalist has done. So the criminalist today feels pressure to produce exhibits that grab the jury's attention. In terms of criminal behavior, I don't think these shows have had much of an effect. Certainly, one can point to isolated cases where these shows have had an effect, but truth be told, the vast majority of criminals are rather stupid, and they assume they will not be caught and therefore take no precautions to avoid leaving physical evidence.
Are these shows accurate when they show people doing their jobs?
No. They're entertainment. Purely entertainment.
Now, back in 2001, the Debbie Smith Act was passed to provide federal funding to state and local crime labs to test DNA evidence, and it gave these agencies $500 million over the last 5 years. The act is set to expire next year, and there's still a lot of backlog DNA cases. So if this act is not renewed, is that going to hurt criminal justice?
Yes, it will. The more DNA evidence is used, the greater uses are found for it. It is, as a single piece of physical evidence, it is certainly the most probative, gives you the most information in terms of identifying a suspect and tying a suspect to a particular crime. And as a consequence, everybody in the system wants to see DNA evidence. The prosecutor wants to see it, the judge wants to see it, the jury wants to see it. And often the defense wants to see it because it could be favorable to the defense. So even though there's more people doing it, more labs doing it, more equipment doing it, the backlog continues to grow.
Well, Duane, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Duane Mose is a retired criminalist from the California Department of Justice. He is now an instructor in criminalistics at National University in San Diego. DNA testing affects the convicted, the accused, and the victims. In April of this year, Nathaniel Hatchett was set free after serving 12 years in prison for a rape he didn't commit. DNA tests exonerated him of the 1996 assault. For another look at DNA testing, we have Donna McNeilan, professor and co-director of the Cooley Innocence Project in Lansing, Michigan, and Bruce Cook, founder and executive director of the Crime Victims Advocacy Council. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Donna, I'm going to start with you. Tell us briefly about the Hatchett case.
Well, the Hatchett case was a case where Mr. Hatchett was convicted about 12 years ago for the carjacking, kidnapping, and rape of a married woman. After the police picked him up on the crime, he was actually found driving the victim's car 4 days after the crime occurred. They took him in for questioning, and after a period of interrogation, Mr. Hatchett confessed to the crime. What we found during our investigation was that the facts that he gave in his confession were very different than the facts that the victim had given, and it sort of indicated to us that maybe someone who didn't have the facts exactly right had sort of fed the facts to him. Mr. Hatchett claimed that he came upon the car parked in his neighborhood in Detroit and that the car had been abandoned for a number of days. At the time, he was a high school student, and him and a group of friends skipped school, and his claim is that they sort of hot-wired the car and were out joyriding in it when the police picked him up. DNA evidence at the time, or just prior to trial, was taken, and it actually excluded him at the time of trial. However, the prosecution's theory at trial was that exclusion wasn't really material because she was a married woman, and the source of the biological evidence that they obtained from the rape kit actually could have come from her husband. Surprisingly, nobody kind of questioned at trial why there wasn't a DNA test taken, or at least a DNA sample taken from the husband and compared to the biological evidence from the rape kit.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that in some cases or in some aspects of this case, there was sloppy police work. What led you to actually get him exonerated and get him out of jail?
Well, that's just the thing. I'm not sure it was sloppy police work, because what we found during our investigation was that at some point somebody actually did take a sample from the husband and found out that the husband was excluded. How that didn't get out is sort of beyond us. We're not sure what happened. What we ended up doing is retesting the husband's sample, retesting all the biological evidence from the crime, and then we found that the husband definitely was excluded. Mr. Hatchett was definitely excluded. And the only explanation based on the facts and the witnesses or the victim's testimony and her statements to the emergency room that she had not had any sort of consensual sex for a week led us to determine that the only source of the biological material could have been the perpetrators.
Very briefly, was anyone ever caught who was the actual perpetrator in this case?
Unfortunately, no. What there is right now is there's a national CODIS bank that has profiles of people who have been convicted of crimes. We did run the sample against that CODIS bank and have not gotten a hit.
Bruce, I'm going to turn to you now. You help crime victims cope, deal with their pain. How do people handle the news if they find out that the wrong person was in prison and then the true perpetrator is still free?
Well, no victim of a violent crime ever wants an innocent man to suffer needlessly. And DNA exonerations, we view it as necessary as a check and balance to ensure that justice is actually served. But the crime victims, when they find out it's the wrong person, it's tough. It's re-traumatizing. In two-thirds of the cases, they don't even find out who the person is from the DNA exoneration. About one-third they do. So that leaves them hanging again. Who is this person out there who committed this heinous crime?
There was an article yesterday in the Baltimore Sun where the victim was not notified that her abuser's sentence was reduced. That's just one of many cases where there's a question of how the criminal justice system communicates with victims. From your standpoint, from your advocacy standpoint, what would improve communications between elements of the criminal justice system and people who've been victimized?
Well, notification is a basic crime victim rights, one of the crime victim rights in 50 states now. So failure to notify that a sentence was reduced is failure to let a victim know on the status of the case, and that's a violation of the Crime Victim Bill of Rights in each state. We need a national Crime Victim Bill of Rights that has teeth in it, that doesn't just deal with federal but also with state and local. Right now, our national Crime Victim Bill of Rights deals mainly with federal.
From your standpoint, again, as a victim's advocate, how important is DNA? Because, as we mentioned earlier, DNA can lead to both convictions and exonerations.
It's very important, and I think from what I'm hearing, DNA backlogs are a serious problem. They need funding to get the backlog handled. And I suggest even that maybe offender fines and fees be an element to pay for that.
Donna, back to you. When you take a look not just at this one exoneration, but at the patterns. How does race play into the patterns of people who have been, that we at least discover, have been wrongly convicted and then exonerated?
Well, what we find is that race is a big factor. Eyewitness misidentification is one of the leading factors in these wrongful convictions. 75% of the first exonerations were the result of misidentification by eyewitness. And when the race factor comes into play, it amplifies those numbers.
Bruce, from your perspective, since eyewitness testimony is not always correct, how do you counsel victims in terms of their responsibility once they go on the stand, or do you talk to them about it at all?
Well, what we try to tell them is to be flexible, because the criminal justice system is not perfect, and there are flaws, there are errors made. We try to counsel them to be flexible to handle the different ways in which the trial plays out. Sometimes they get the right person and he gets off with a technical loophole, and that's very difficult. Sometimes they never find the person, and crime victims are left wondering forever who did this. This DNA exoneration is one way of getting the right person and making sure we have the right person.
Donna, not all, and I believe not most, exonerations are DNA-based. Do you work on the ones that are not DNA-based as well?
Well, currently we don't. We don't have the resources to do that. There are many clinics and many attorneys out there that are working on those cases, but it's not us.
So you specifically are sticking with DNA. And how, when you look at the pattern of cases that you've dealt with, is it often a case where DNA samples were taken, but what they said was not heeded, you know, as in the Hatchett case, or whether there was not a DNA sample taken at the time? I mean, what are we really talking about?
Most of the cases that we work with are cases that where the conviction occurred before there was DNA testing. Michigan statute only provides for inmates to bring a petition if they were convicted prior to 2001. So this was a rare case for us.
Now, Bruce, we talked earlier with a forensic scientist about the Debbie Smith Act. It was funding, or it is funding, forensic science investigations at the local and state level for the past 5 years. You just mentioned funding. Do you have an advocacy position on continuing or renewing this act, which could help at least mitigate some of the backlog in DNA testing?
We're not only in favor of that, we're in favor of state and local funding to supplement it so we can reduce this backlog. A crime victim is waiting out there thinking that, you know, this is the right person and that this person's now doing time for this rape or this murder. It's very important that any kind of DNA testing that might prove guilt be established early on, so that there's not this secondary victimization or trauma again when they find out they got the wrong person.
And Donna, how is Hatchett doing now that he's been released?
You know, it's too early to tell. He's not been out a very long time, and I got to be honest, there's no resources for him. A lot of things have changed in the last 12 years. He's struggling, and, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to work out.
Well, Donna, Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Donna McNeilan is a professor and co-director of the Cooley Innocence Project at Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan. And Bruce Cook is the founder and executive director of the Crime Victims Advocacy Council. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Are video games eating Hollywood's lunch? What new sites are drawing black audiences? And should Yahoo have accepted a buyout offer from Microsoft? Our tech contributor Mario Armstrong has the scoop. It's good to have you back, Mario.
Hey, Farai, glad to be here.
So let's start with Grand Theft Auto 4. It raked in $500 million the first week it was on sale. Now,
yeah.
What makes up this kind of game? What makes it so sticky?
I mean, this thing, I mean, can you imagine it? $500 million. I mean, you look at Iron Man that just came out, right? What was that, $201 million and within their opening weekend? And you have a video game that's brought in $500 million. So Grand Theft Auto, this is the fourth one. It's a series of very controversial games. They've always been in the spotlight for their storyline, for the violence that's portrayed in the games. And so I think that's actually given it a lot more media hype and a lot more attention, but there is something to say about the gameplay. I mean, if the game wasn't good or if people didn't enjoy playing the games, they certainly would not sell. So it has been very successful in that from that perspective. And I have to tell you, playing the game myself on the Xbox 360 and seeing it on the PlayStation 3, its realism is a little bit more than I've ever seen or witnessed in a Grand Theft Auto series before. It actually feels, I don't know, morally, I actually feel a little bit more responsible for some of my actions, even if I know I'm goofing off. It's just that the realism there is just that good.
I've seen the screen grabs of it, and it looks absolutely beautiful. I myself have not seriously played video games in a while. I played them when I was younger, and I could see myself losing my job. I could just basically sit around the house for days at a time, you know, playing something like this. So I don't know if
that's happened.
I don't know if I'm ever going to crack one of these
people
open.
Call out sick, and they actually monitor how much an impact a video game has for the movies that were released, for how many people call out sick, and whether worker productivity goes down. So this isn't, you know, an isolated event.
You were mentioning the violence of some of the previous versions. Is it still the kind of game where, for example, you can shoot a police officer virtually?
Yeah, absolutely. It still is that type of game. I mean, this is a mature rated game, which means theoretically that you cannot purchase this game unless you are 17 or older. So it does have violence. It does have partial nudity in the game. And one thing that's caught some attention by the Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the game is there is a component or an element where you can actually, you make a choice, however, whether or not you grab a drink at a bar and then go driving, and then the screen simulates what that experience would be like. And so Mothers Against Drunk Driving have stepped out on that. But this is an adult title. There is, on the box, it says there's alcohol, there's drugs, there's partial nudity, intense violence. So you really want to be concerned if, you know, younger audiences are playing this game, you better make sure their maturity level can handle it.
We talked about the visuals, but reviewers also say the soundtrack is great. Let's take a listen to the trailer.
We got real problems. Anyway, this is my time. Young enough for life.
LCPD, freeze, I said freeze!
Well, that's definitely, you know, kind of a hip-hop beat, you know, club beat. What's the music like?
Man, the music, this thing, the box set that I ended up receiving, the music is unbelievable. And that's been part of also this hype that you talked about too, Farai. Like, how come this game is so popular? Well, you know, they have some of the best musicians, some great independent artists that are on here. So the music soundtrack that you play, you are driving a lot throughout the game, so you can change stations, you can change genres. And so you're discovering new artists and you're listening to some of your favorite artists, and the music soundtrack of this thing is scored like a movie. I mean, this development cost about $100 million to develop this game. So this is really showing a monumental shift and the amount of money being allocated to even develop a game. We really haven't heard of numbers this high before, but we're talking about a video game industry that rakes in about $18 billion a year, so it's not a small industry.
Wow. Well, speaking of billions of dollars, they came, they asked, they got a no. We are talking about Microsoft's $44.6 billion offer to buy Yahoo, and Yahoo said neener, neener, and cut an ad deal with Google instead. So should Yahoo have taken the offer?
No, you know, right now, this is one of those, the neener neener is a really great way of putting it, because this thing almost played out like it was a Dallas show on TV or something, just trying to figure out what was going to happen with these California rivals trying to work it out with each other. At the end of the day, you know, I think Yahoo may have made a smart decision. I'm being hopeful for that. I'm being totally speculative on this point. If they can work out this partnership with Google, which is what the game changer has been, why Microsoft walked away from this deal, and that is a proposed opportunity for Google to allow Yahoo to use its search advertising technology. And its search advertising technology is probably the best on the web. So that made Yahoo feel like, hey, we actually have another option. Maybe we don't have to sell out. Maybe we can just utilize some licensing from our partner slash competitor and still be able to keep our brand intact. So it all remains to be seen, but I think it may have worked out that they didn't do it.
Let me throw another company into the mix. What about AOL? After the big AOL-Time Warner merger in 2000, the combined company lost billions of dollars. Now, yeah. Time Warner dropped AOL from its name, fired the AOL CEO, now wants to offload the company. Are any of these three companies we're talking about, Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft, going to belly up and buy AOL, you think?
You know, that's something that is highly discussed. AOL is going through some serious challenges. We've met with some of their executives over other projects that had to be put off, be delayed, in fact, because of some of these issues. Their headquarters in Dulles, Virginia has now changed. They've moved a lot of people out to New York City to try to play more of an advertising role and an advertising partner. So I still think AOL has a strong brand, although I think that brand is with an older audience. I think they've been trying to reinvent themselves. Some of the acquisitions, though, in video has been really smart on their part, like Truvio and some of their video search technology that they've been using, really shows that they can still be a player, but I don't know if they can be the player that they once used to be, that dominant player. So it is very likely that we might see them get scooped up by someone else larger in the next few months to come.
All right, Mario, we don't have much time, but we do have two black and urban online communities we want to take a look at, globalgrind.com and rushmoredrive.com. What do you think of them? And, you know, who's their target audience? What are they doing? Let's start with Global Grind.
Okay, starting with Global Grind, here's the deal, Fry. As you know, being in the media, it's becoming more and more niche. And people, especially when you're talking about internet, you're talking about web communities, and defining that niche, now we're seeing more and more websites pop up where we've had black websites in the past. But Global Grind is this one-stop shop they claim or they offer for news, gossip, humor, entertainment. It's just about everything that users think is important. So the whole site is actually driven by users voting on other content that's happening elsewhere. And so the higher the vote of a specific piece of content, the more relevant it comes up on the Global Grind webpage.
Is it
fun?
So if
you're familiar, it is fun. It looks very clean. It's slick. I do like the ownership behind the company and some of the people driving it because Navarro is a guy that ran 360hiphop.com, which was very successful. That was sold to BET. I've met with their advertising people. I think they really got their handle on, they've made it mobile. They now integrate it with Facebook, which wasn't there before, which I was dinging them on. I was like, when are you guys going to get with mobile applications in the Web 2.0 space?
All right, Mario, we have to jump in. Rushmore Drive.
Okay.
Give me the
Rushmore Drive.
The skinny. Yeah,
the skinny is this is a black search engine, and I think it's time for a black search engine. The answer is going. The question is going to be whether or not this will be successful due to advertising. The Pew Internet says that 56% of African Americans now use the internet. So, is there really a need for a black search engine? I put in Farai Chidea. I was able to see news about you, videos, your blog posts, images.
Scary.
It is comprehensive. It's clean. Hey, you're all over the place. What can I say? I think there's a real need for this. The issue is going to be whether or not they can market it right.
All right. On that note, have a great weekend, Mario.
You do the same, Farai.
Mario Armstrong is our regular tech contributor, and he joined me from WYPR's studios in Baltimore, Maryland. From a Nigerian doctor on the run to a captive South African political activist to a flamboyant transvestite, British-born actor Chiwetel Ejiofor can do it all. In his new martial arts drama Red Belt, he plays Mike Terry, a Gulf War veteran and jiu-jitsu instructor. Ejiofor's character becomes the victim of a con, then he joins the world of underground combat, where he fights to pay off his debts and regain his honor.
I think it's going to be a great fight. I don't know why everybody's not coming to this fight.
We need a gimmick. What good's a deal if nobody's making any money?
Tie him up.
Your check bounced.
My check?
The martial arts supply. I can't make the rent. You have no cash.
There's one rule. Put the other guy down.
Who imposes the terms of the battle will impose the terms of the peace.
Each fighter will pick a marble. Should he pick a white marble, he'll be given a pass.
You want to make some money?
Fight on the undercard. It's worth a quarter of a mil.
Competition is weakening.
What about the fighter's family? What do they eat?
The fight is fixed. We pick who gets the white marble. Who gets the pass tonight? You.
I caught up with Ejiofor, who described his character Mike Terry and the challenges of playing the role.
You know, when I first read the part, I knew that the only key into it and into the mindset of Mike Terry was through jiu-jitsu and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and sort of understanding through the physical what was going on psychologically for this guy. You know, I started just the process of training in jiu-jitsu and learning about jiu-jitsu, and through that found that I could have keys into some of the codes, the sort of moral codes that Mike Terry practices.
So what kind of regime did you have to go through in order to play this role?
You know, it's a very physical martial art. You know, you have to, obviously, there's a sense of learning the moves and, you know, how they all relate to each other so that you can, you know, it's a submission contest. And so you have to learn all the locks and how to get out of them and so on. And also you, because it's a submission contest, in any bout, there's no bell. These bouts can go on ad infinitum. So people need a lot of stamina, a lot of strength. And so there was a lot of that, a lot of just building up, you know, physically and getting physically very fit to do the part.
You want to fight like a black belt?
Huh? You want to test for the black belt? Snowflake, give him his wish.
All right, raise your hands. Put your hands, get him up.
Administer the fight. Administer the fight. Insist. Breathe through it. The moves work. Defend the neck. Take the fight out of your face. Breathe.
We just did an interview with an author who does different types of fighting. Some of them are more mixed martial arts. Some of them are more street fighting. And one of the things I talked to him about was the idea of whether or not fighting in today's world is considered moral. Is it something, you know, it's something we glorify, but it's also something that's frowned upon. So in the context of this movie Red Belt, how does that question of honor, morality, modernity play out? You know, what's your character struggling with in this movie?
Well, my character is somebody who puts the honor and the morality at the forefront of his expression through martial arts. You know, the sense of competing for commerce is something that he doesn't believe in and won't do. And the reason why he trains people is to defend themselves and to prevail through that defense. And the complexities of the world surrounding fight come to bear in the sense of the whole nature of the fight world and the fact that there are riches to be made through fighters. And, you know, he has stark choices to make.
You tell me how we can run your academy without money. You tell me that's how I can do it and not disturb you in your purity. There are some things I don't understand. My father made money. My brothers make money. And you are somehow superior to compete.
It
weakens the fighter.
That's right.
Because a competition is not a fight.
That's correct.
And what about the fighter's family, Mike? What do they eat while he's being so pure?
David Mamet isn't known as much for action as he is for dialogue and for this very tightly wound, tightly scripted interplay between people. Were you surprised when you found out that he was doing a movie set in this very physical world?
Yes, I was surprised. The work that I was familiar with of David's work wasn't really of this style or this genre. And you know, it wasn't until really I read the script and everything that I realized that, you know, in many ways it does fit his oeuvre in a lot of ways. And also it is a something separate, and I think it does sort of stand on its own. And it's a really fascinating dissection of two completely different cultures within the sort of Los Angeles, the wider Los Angeles culture.
We have here one of those random notes that you get about actors, and it says, cooking is your secret talent. Is that in fact true?
It's very secret.
Is it secret even from you?
Sometimes it is. I think I can get some good things going.
What's your genre?
Well, you know, I just try and throw things together. It's very improvisational. It's, it depends on mood. And, you know, obviously what's left in the fridge. Occasionally, like any good magician, you know, things go wrong. But most of the time, you know, things cook up pretty good.
So if there was a show that was kind of like Iron Chef meets the Actor's Studio, then you could dominate that?
I would feel that that would be something that I would definitely like to have a go at. Yeah, I think that should be created, actually.
Absolutely. So what else would you like to do? And what I mean by that is that, you know, so many people who are talented actors also want to go on and direct or write or any number of other things. When you see your, you know, the path ahead of yourself, what else would you like to have manifest on that path?
Well, I find this, you know, art form and this particular career, you know, incredibly exciting just because it does offer, you know, extraordinary diversity in different avenues. And, you know, I'm in many ways, I'm very interested in all of them. You know, everything is kind of project based and ideas based and movement based and time based and all those things. But I think it's thrilling. The prospect of being involved in writing and directing and producing is always exciting and, you know, just offers so many opportunities.
What else have you got on tap?
Well, I'm going to be doing a film about the end of the apartheid, playing Thabo Mbeki. You know, just about the circumstances in the late 80s and early 90s that led to the fall of apartheid. The film's called Endgame.
Well, Chiwetel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Actor Chiwetel Ejiofor is the star of Red Belt.